We're back with another episode of Schneps Connects. And again, I want to remind everybody, please become a part of Schneps Connects, not just by listening to the podcast, but by attending monthly business networking events that we're hosting out on Long Island. And each event has a keynote conversation with an amazing industry leader. So check out schnepsconnects.com, sign up to attend one of our events, and hopefully you'll learn more about everything that we do. And certainly, if you're listening to this podcast, you know that we're on all podcast platforms and our own website, podcast.schnepsmedia.com. We're going to delve into healthcare today, and I'm really happy to be joined by Sean T. Granahan, who's the president and general counsel of The Floating Hospital. The Floating Hospital was founded in 1866. They provide a tremendous number of services, including medical, dental, behavioral health care, critical support services, all different types of programs and resources for families and individuals in need. Sean leads one of New York City's largest providers of charity health care. So those families could be homeless shelters, living in homeless shelters, or domestic violence abuse victims living in safe houses. Since joining the organization in 2003, he's helped transform it from near bankruptcy into a thriving operation, growing its budget more than fourfold and significantly expanding its reach and impact across the city. With a background in healthcare policy, law, and operations, Sean oversees a team of approximately 200 clinical, financial, and administrative staff, managing everything from day-to-day operations to legal affairs and strategic growth. Prior to his current role, he worked at Epstein, Becker, and Green, where he handled major litigation and advised healthcare clients on complex regulatory matters. So, Sean, I'm happy to have you here, and I'm really happy that you're going to share everything that the Floating Hospital does.
Great. Thank you, and I appreciate being here.
And we have to make clear, the Floating Hospital is no longer floating.
We are on solid ground.
Is that right?
That is correct. We are no longer floating. We're fully land-based. We became focused on our land-based services after 9/11. 9/11 was the last day that we maintained ship operations. We were down at the South Street Seaport, and when the towers fell, the debris went across the island, and the South Street Seaport was used as a means of taking debris out and bringing new building materials in. So we lost our dock space. We went over to the Brooklyn Navy Yards. We were there for a while. And then ultimately, my predecessor sold Delilah, which was the name of our barge. Today, she sits up in Kingston, on the river, up in Kingston. And she's in pretty rough shape. But we've been up there a couple of times. We've spoken to the people that own it. And, you know, to see if there's any ideas about maybe bringing her back to life and bringing her on the water. So we're still on that conversation.
So talk a little bit about what got you involved in this role. I mean, obviously, it sounds like you're a corporate attorney. Definitely good to be an attorney leading an organization because attorneys are expensive. So anytime you could probably handle the matters yourself, the better. But I imagine it's a real shift, though, right? Going from being a lawyer to running a nonprofit.
Before I went to Epstein, Becker, and Green, I was in the trucking and warehousing business as an attorney for about 4 years, closer to 5 years. And in those roles, I was running departments. So I already had some management experience from doing that. And then when I was at the firm, we worked on the World Trade Center litigation, the Two Towers issue. We were representing the broker. And so I was working on covering for the broker, so to speak. And at that time, I had the Floating Hospital, myself and others, actually, a few of us were advising the Floating Hospital as a client.
Got it.
I knew the people over there. I had worked on like three or four different matters for them at this particular point. And then in speaking to them afterwards, I had a couple of conversations. I was ready to go back in-house again. I had been at the firm about close to 7 years at that point. I was ready to go back in-house, and I frankly didn't know what I wanted to do. So I went to the Floating Hospital really just to kill the summer. And, you know, that was 23 years ago. So it was a very long summer.
I love it. Yeah. We talked about how the Floating Hospital literally went from, you know, that barge to being, you know, brick and mortar. But what was the original founding of the floating hospital? And going back all those years, what was it primarily serving, or what was the foundation that got started?
I think what's really like genuinely unique about the floating hospital is the fact that it is actually doing the exact same thing it did in 1866. And it hasn't stopped in that entire time. It hasn't been purchased by anybody else. It's remained a small private charity hospital. And it's done consistently the same work, which is three legs of a stool. First is healthcare in whatever form it happens to be, in whatever decade you're talking about. The second is health education. So we were providing health education back in the 1860s, except then the health education was figuring out whether the milk you were purchasing was actually milk or was it chalk water or, other types of fake milk or adulterated milk at the time. And then the third component has always been relief, which we continue to do. So we provide food, clothes, diapers, whatever families need when they walk in the door, we provide on top of the health education and on top of the medical services. So we've consistently done the same thing. We've actually even consistently kept the same general business model in the sense that back in 1866, we traveled from the docks over to the tenement houses, brought the families from the tenement houses over to the ship at services. And then today, we send out a bunch of minibuses to all the family homeless shelters, all the domestic violence safe houses, and some of the families that are doubled up with families and friends. And we pick them up and we bring them to the clinic. I would put a caveat on there. We obviously don't go directly to the safe houses. In the case of safe houses, we don't want our drivers knowing where the safe houses are. So we have designated pickup spots with all the different safe houses. So they send the family someplace, we go pick them up at that spot.
You know, I love to hear that you're able to go back to the original mission 160 years ago and say, still doing the work that we were doing before, maybe differently, but I love to hear that because how many organizations, whether nonprofit or for profit, last that long and can stay true to their mission, which is really important. So talk more about your services because I really think the audience should understand the diversity of services that you provide and where people go to get those services, as well as the kinds of people that you're servicing. I mean, you mentioned some of those homeless shelters and safe houses, but I think it's much broader than that.
For us, the actual population is families. We focus and we specialize in families. We always look from a mission perspective for the families who are the poorest or have the greatest needs. And so for us in New York City today, that is homeless families. And so there's a difference between treating what they generally refer to as street homeless. So if you think of the single male or the single female, usually someone with some significant mental health issues, and there's generally some type of drug use or alcohol use involved as well. When you think of that population, that is not us. We don't do that because you need an emergency room, frankly, to treat that group. And you need either like a psych ward, like in a traditional hospital. We don't really do any of that work. Instead, we focus on homeless families. They're the largest component of the homeless population in New York City. There's over 100,000 homeless kids in the New York City school system.
Wow,
If you think
sad.
about, yeah, it's
That's a
huge.
sad reality, yeah.
Like I said, they live either in shelters, they live in hotels and motels. There's literally tens of thousands that live in the hotels and motels scattered around the city on the edge of the boroughs. So they live in food deserts, pharmacy deserts, store deserts. So our buses go, we pick them up, we bring them back to the main clinic. They can get food, they can get clothes. We have a pharmacy. And so, in terms of services, we provide primary medical care, behavioral health services, dental services. We cover infectious disease as well and podiatry. We actually spend a good portion of the time we have with the families on like health education classes for the kids. And we focus a lot on literacy because literacy is a big issue for a lot of homeless mothers.
Sure, I could imagine. When you say children, what's kind of an age range that you serve?
Primarily 0 to 10 are just population of the kids. It's usually a young mother, two or three kids, and the mothers come from primarily three situations. One is eviction in a multiple family apartment.
Okay.
So usually, like, think of a grandmother that has a large public housing apartment, and she may have two of her daughters living with her, their children, occasional boyfriends coming in and out of that situation. And then one of the granddaughters gets pregnant, and it's just one too many. And so they'll find themselves evicted. So that's one big issue. The second is domestic violence. It's a huge driver in the poorer populations, and it's a huge driver across the board in terms of women leaving homes and relationships. The third area, which is maybe surprising, is foster care. So foster care produces an enormous amount of homeless mothers. You know, as young girls cycle out of foster care, a lot of times they're basically left to their own devices. And the best way to get cared for or to find shelter is to have a child. So the system sadly encourages pregnancy, you know, for the wrong reasons, basically, but it does.
Interesting. Hey, listen, you're seeing it all firsthand, I'm sure, through the clinic. So talk about the clinic a little bit. You know, in Long Island City, you have really a lot of thought that went through the layout and design of the space, but share a little bit more for people to understand what that Long Island City clinic offers and is all about.
Sure. So after 9/11, we moved our main site to East Broadway in Manhattan, and we stayed there for a while. Ultimately, though, we needed to find ourselves a new home. The Long Island City where we are, it's this 11101 zip code. It was a medically underserved area. We were able to get the designation from the federal government, and they agreed to kick in and treat it as a new site. And so
So
we
does that give you extra funding?
it does. It gives us
Okay.
extra funding. It gives us a better Medicaid rate, gives us
Oh,
some
interesting.
base funding to help
Okay.
offset some salaries with. We got some money from the federal government. And more importantly, it gives us free malpractice insurance. Kind of love that, right?
Interesting. Okay,
Yeah.
great.
So that designation really helped us. The medically underserved area designation was very helpful. And so we opened up in 2004, right on Queens Plaza North, where the subway for the QNRW attaches to the building. A Greek family owned it. And we were there from 2004 until 2020. Probably about in 2018 or 19, we started looking for a new space, and we pulled together the funding, and we renovated three floors directly across the street from Queensbridge on 41st and 21st on the corner there, right above the F train.
Yes.
And so we renovated three full floors. It gave us double the square footage we had before. And it was one of those things that was really an adventure in terms of trying to build during COVID, because the governor had placed a moratorium on most construction projects except hospitals. Problem is, the Department of Buildings really didn't know this. And so, you know, we had to keep going back to the Department of Buildings, and they would close us on Monday. We would go back on Tuesday. They'd
Wow.
reopen us on Friday. They'd close us the following Monday because we, you know, it was always different inspectors. You know, that was a bit of an adventure and dragged on a little bit of the construction, but it all, we
But
all
you made it happen.
exactly. And it's three floors of large open spaces, lots of windows. It's bright, it's designed, it's kid friendly. And the health education component straddles the waiting rooms so that the families can go in and out of the health education world. And they can do everything from learning how to cook to, you know, getting clothes to teaching kids the best foods to eat and how to be concerned about predators and other things. So
I
it's
mean,
a
if I'm not mistaken, I
fun.
think you're right across from the largest nature development in the country, let
We are
alone New York
in North
City, right?
America, believe it or not.
In North America.
Yeah, the combined Queensbridge Ravenwood houses is the largest in North America.
So, I mean, you must be a blessing to the people living there because it's a tremendous community there. And to be
It's
able to
a
have healthcare in their backyard is certainly something that they needed.
sure. And we're one of the few federally qualified health center NYCHA tenants. So we have a small satellite office directly in the NYCHA housing as well
I
that,
didn't realize that.
yeah, so we can send patients back and forth for either dental services or other services that we can't see in the satellite.
So you mentioned you qualified for that federal funding, but I have to imagine all nonprofits are fighting for every penny they can. So where else are you getting funding from, and are there ways that people can make donations as well?
Sure. So the most difficult thing for us is covering the broad extent of services that we provide that aren't reimbursable. So health education, the transportation service, none of that is billable to Medicaid. None of it is government funded. And so we have to fundraise for it. We have to do it the old-fashioned way and pass the hat. The other issue for us is that moms with kids routinely fall out of Medicaid. And so in those periods when they have to recertify and they don't have what they need to recertify and they fall out, we still have to see the kids because it's part of our charity mission. So for every family that walks in the door, I should say for every four families that walk in the door, one of those families will not have any insurance at all.
So you're serving a quarter of people that don't have insurance.
Yeah. So, and to put that in perspective, the average nonprofit hospital provides about 1 to 1.5% charity rate. The floating
Wow.
hospital has a 25% charity rate.
So how are you making that up? How are you able to afford that?
Pass the hat.
So you're very much
We're very
needing
focused on,
donations and focused on fundraising.
it's a third of what we do.
Wow. So, what are some of those major fundraising initiatives? I have to imagine also you have to be doing something big around your 160th anniversary.
So on June 2nd, we're having our 160th birthday party. It's our annual gala. We have it at the Hotel Edison. Duke Ellington's grandson has been a friend of ours for the last 10, 15 years. So he comes and he plays with a big 10-piece jazz orchestra for the night. And we don't really do the honoree thing. We usually make it
Okay.
a short, sweet program and we show video of our work and then, we ask for money, which
Good.
is what you do at these
You don't
events.
ask, you don't get.
You don't ask, you don't get. Exactly. And then we have an annual appeal. We have the basics that all nonprofits have to do, but we also have a very strong volunteer corps. And, volunteers are generally donors, and there's a lot for volunteers to do in our organization. And so that helps us generate, people who want to help out.
That's great. I'm glad you have. Listen, sometimes it's a blessing and it's a curse when you need to raise private funds, but
Sure.
at least, creates an opportunity for you to develop relationships with people that want to give and that you're not solely relying on, federal money or even, state and city funds, because
True.
sometimes those can disappear too.
Absolutely.
Has there been any impact on federal funds for you since
It
I?
hasn't happened yet, and it's one of those kind of storm clouds that are threatening. There have been several of the executive orders have the potential to impact us. Some aspects of the Big Beautiful Bill may impact us, but there are a lot of lawsuits going on, and at the moment, the dust just hasn't settled yet.
Oh, listen, as long as you're continuing to get your
Hey,
money, that's good news.
as long as it keeps, keeping us moving, right? That's the important thing.
Well, listen, you deserve every penny you're getting. You're serving a community that desperately needs those services. And, so glad you could share your mission and the work that you're doing. And hopefully somebody listening here will be able to give.
That would be great. We would appreciate it.
It was a pleasure talking to you, and
Yes.
I'm looking forward to my tour. I want to,
Wonderful.
take
Good.
a tour and see the space myself because
Yes.
it's really, a great
It's
role that you're
meaningful work,
playing.
and it makes people happy. I have to say it always makes people happy to come see us.
Well,
Great.
thank you again for your
Thank
time. It
you.
was a pleasure
Appreciate
to
it.
hear more about the hospital.
And thanks for having me. I
My
appreciate it.
pleasure.
Thanks. Bye-bye.